It's difficult to describe the television show Battlestar Galactica without sounding, well, a little geeky. But here it goes. It's about humans and a race of robots called Cylons. The Cylons nuked the humans' planets, but some humans survived, so they went flying across the universe in search of a new home. Did I mention that the Cylons look like humans? Oh, and that some of the Cylons are kind of good? You get the idea. But the show is about much more than sci-fi swashbuckling. It's about human rights and terrorism, about the nature of conflict and what it means to be human. In fact, the show's themes are so relevant to what's happening in the world today that a screening and discussion panel was organized this past week at the United Nations. The series ended last night on the Sci-Fi Channel. We're joined now by actress Mary McDonnell, who played Laura Roslin, the president of the 12 colonies on Battlestar Galactica. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm quite happy to be here. Thank you.
What is it about the show that attracted such a rabid fan base, do you think?
Well, I do think that the show allows people to see the situation we're in presently completely honestly and in a very sort of raw and honest, open, politically, environmentally, emotionally, spiritually, we're seeing where we are. And that's a very difficult thing to face. The science fiction aspect of it opens it up so that we're able to see it through that lens, which gives us a little bit of distance on the mire that we're stuck in. And one has a little bit more courage to be able to interact with the ideas because we can view it through a bigger idea, which gives us hope. So I think it's just allowing people to get down with the issues that we face daily, but do it with a little more confidence that we're going to come out of it.
In the efforts of full disclosure, I'm going to admit that I'm more of a fair weather fan than a rabid fan. So
yes.
if you don't mind, I'd actually like to use a lifeline.
Yes.
I'd like to bring someone into our conversation. Casey, are you there?
I'm here.
Mary McDonnell, this is my daughter, Casey Conan.
Casey.
Hi.
I'll just preface this by saying she hasn't seen the ending, even though the show has ended. She's basically saving the last episodes up to view all together. But I thought she might have some more cogent questions for you. So would you mind talking to Casey?
I wouldn't mind at all. And Casey, I promise you I will not spoil anything for you.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask about some of like the darker areas of the show. Like, it's no stretch to say that this is a dark show.
Absolutely.
Jane Espenson is famous for saying, "The humor is so dark you can't see it against a black wall." This is not a show that's obviously afraid to kill people off, sometimes right. Very, very randomly. And I'm just wondering, what is it like as an actor to be like, well, you know, Ron Moore, he kind of likes killing us off. He might kill me off this episode.
Well, it's a great question. And I think that most of the other actors would have a different answer. I knew from the very beginning that Laura Roslin's life was in danger. Mm-hmm. So I kind of got used to it before I agreed to play the part. Because in the miniseries, her very first scene is she is told that she has terminal cancer. And it was kind of interesting for me because even though Ron and I met at lunch around that time, and he did at the time say that she would probably go in and out of remission, I felt like, well, but one never knows, does one? Therefore, I better be very good at this. But I think that I was already accepting of my mortality as a character, which kind of gave me that feeling of life is short the entire time I was playing it, which I think would have been different for me had I played a character whose death had never been an issue.
Yeah, it is sort of interesting that the one character that has been, you know, threatening to die for the entire series
is still living.
Is still around.
No, the ironies of life.
Well, Casey, I'm going to let you go because I want to ask Mary about the ending. Thanks a lot for doing my job for me. I'll send you a lapel pin, okay?
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Now, were you happy with the way the series ended for the show and for your character?
I was very happy for both. I think the show does a remarkable job of reaching into the future and creating, in my opinion, a great deal of hope. Mm-hmm. When I saw the ending, I was quite impressed with the scope of responsibility taken. A big theme of Battlestar is patience. Once you're finished, you look back and realize that a key to survival and evolution is forgiveness. And I'm really, really, really proud.
Mary McDonnell, star of the just-concluded TV series Battlestar Galactica on the Sci-Fi Channel. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Finally today, a tribute to Citizen Kafka. That's how Richard Schulberg was known to the fans of his New York radio show, a comic enterprise that helped launch the career of John Goodman, among others. Schulberg was also a musician, and by all accounts, an unrepentant comedic force in the lives of just about anyone who knew him. He died last weekend at the age of 61 after a series of illnesses. John Kalish has this appreciation.
One of Richard Schulberg's employers once described his resume as one of the most entertaining documents he'd ever read. Schulberg worked as a miner, a projectionist, a teacher, and a professional musician.
I was the only union theremin player in New York for years. Yeah, that sound.
Schulberg was also a fiddler in the Wretched Refuse String Band. Its alumni include such standouts as Tony Trischka and Andy Statman. But Schulberg will likely be remembered by most people for his work in a different medium.
It's the Citizen Kafka Show. It's time to have fun today.
I'm Scary Duty.
The Citizen Kafka Show went on the air in 1980 on non-commercial WBAI-FM in New York. The highly produced multi-track routines featured original music and improvised zaniness that ranged from sophomoric to brilliant. Kenny Kosek, a fiddler who played with Schulberg in Wretched Refuse, was part of the deliberately politically incorrect trio that inspired protests to the FCC and a fiercely loyal following.
When we did the Citizen Kafka Show, we'd laugh until we had cramps and we'd be on the floor weeping.
Kosek and Schulberg were joined in early 1981 by a then-unknown actor named John Goodman, who still remembers Schulberg fondly.
I can't think of him without laughing or smiling. He was always beaming at people. Just great manic energy. It just reminds me of, you know, when he'd break into a spontaneous dance or song, always at the top of his lungs.
Goodman continued to contribute to the show even after moving to Hollywood and becoming a star. John Goodman's voice introduced Schulberg's other radio series, which debuted in 1992.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Secret Museum of the Air, a weekly broadcast of the world's music. Historic landmarks from the dawn of recording through the golden age of the gramophone.
The show was co-hosted by Schulberg and Pat Conte, both of them avid collectors of 78s. Ed Haber is a recording engineer and close friend of Schulberg's.
What he was doing with the Secret Museum to present these rare old 78s, this music that people have forgotten or never knew about. I thought that was a real important contribution to the world.
Many people might say Schulberg's most important contribution was himself. A short, bespectacled man with a shaved head, his antics were the grist for countless stories. One of the most famous involves the time that members of the Wretched Refuse String Band were hired to play in a Broadway show directed by John Houseman. Schulberg was fired after he played Donkey Serenade on his fiddle as Houseman took the stage at a public event. Schulberg remembered the incident in a 2000 NPR interview.
I regret not having the money, but I don't regret doing it. I did a lot of funny things and got in trouble for them. And when I get together with people all the time, they come up with stories and anecdotes of crazy, crazy things that I have done.
Richard Schulberg's friends will be online and on the radio in the coming months, telling stories about the man his wife Annie calls this wonderful, generous, exasperating, and entertaining individual. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Our parting words tonight come in song form, courtesy of Citizen Kafka.
Those wheels of karma go round and round. Sometimes you're a friend, sometimes you're down. Those wheels of karma can make you dance. If you're not good here, you'll come back and...
I don't know about you, I'm coming back as a bird of paradise. That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
Over the past 5 years, there has been a rigorous, messy, emotional exploration of important questions facing our world about torture, religious fundamentalism, and genocide. And it's all been on one TV show, the sci-fi channel's Battlestar Galactica. Well, tonight, the cult favorite ends its run, but before the show went off the air, its fans at the United Nations invited the cast and producers over for a visit. Lara Pellegrinelli went to the Battlestar Galactica panel at the UN and has this report.
If you remember the original Battlestar Galactica from the 1970s, the premise behind the current series is basically the same. Humans from the 12 colonies of Kobol are on the run from the Cylons, a species of genocidal robots they created to be their slaves. This Battlestar Galactica is made to look and feel like a contemporary drama of the highest order, set on a grimy old vessel that's as much a coffin as a refuge.
The very survival of this ship may depend on someone getting an order that they don't want to do. And if they hesitate, if they feel that orders are sometimes optional, then this ship will perish. And so will your son. The entire human race.
There's a level of verisimilitude unusual for sci-fi, down to the subject matter, from sleeper cells to war crimes and secret tribunals, like this one, ordered by presidential decree.
The Circle has examined the evidence and found you guilty of treason and crimes against humanity. Do you have anything to say before sentence is passed?
I'm just trying to help people.
You didn't do a very good job then, did you?
Battlestar Galactica is part of a tradition of science fiction, examining politics and society that goes back to H.G. Wells, says Lou Anders, editorial director for the sci-fi publisher Pyre Books. Take the third season, which hit the air in 2006, a bloody time during the Iraq War.
We were in the midst of a war against an enemy that employs suicide bombers.
And on Battlestar Galactica, the humans, the heroes, were the insurgents against the occupying Cylons.
The protagonists turn into terrorists and bomb not only the Cylons, but their own people that they view as collaborators. The heroes took a sympathetic attitude towards terrorism.
That's why the series caught the attention of the United Nations, where it became the subject for an unusual panel Tuesday evening. Some 500 people took seats in the chamber, a stiff, formal space with miles of dull blonde wood. Delegates to the UN may come from some exotic-sounding faraway places, but it was probably the first time they'd represented other planets.
Representative of Caprica, representative from Eridum.
Whoopi Goldberg, a UNICEF ambassador as well as an Oscar-winning actor, served as the moderator.
It is such an honor, number one, to be here at the UN. But to
ready to talk about the issues explored in the show, the same ones struggled with on a daily basis in that very chamber, UN representatives joined actors Edward James Olmos and Mary McDonnell, Ron Moore, and fellow producer David Icke.
The show tried very hard over the course of its run not to sort of say, guess what, here's the answer to these problems. Here's how we're going to solve torture. Here's how we're going to solve this kind of ticking bomb scenario. It was essentially to say, think about this scenario.
McDonnell plays President Laura Roslin, who on the show sacrificed thousands of innocent civilians and nearly stole an election.
People who are taking these actions that we find unacceptable are sometimes in positions where they don't see the solution. But the experience of that is something we wanted to also expose to people.
Although debates about terrorism and human rights have receded to the background for many Americans, Battlestar Galactica may help the UN meet the challenge of reaching a broader audience. Naima Hakim, a 16-year-old sophomore from Westchester, was one of 100 New York high school students in attendance. She says the show brings home issues in a way that most classroom lessons don't.
When you're watching the show, you don't question why you have to learn it. You understand because it's something that hits the nail on the head, you know?
The series finale for Battlestar Galactica airs on the Sci-Fi Channel tonight. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.
Back now with Day to Day and Emmy-winning actress Jamie Presley. In the TV show My Name is Earl, Presley plays Joy Turner, a feisty woman who strives to get past her trailer park roots.
In high school, my mom gave me a rabbit fur jacket for Christmas. I was so proud to show it off, till one of those rich girls pointed out it was a coat she'd given to Goodwill. She showed everybody where her pet rabbit had humped it. I thought it was an elbow patch.
This week is a busy one for the Petite Blonde. She just finished taping the fourth season of Earl. On Friday, her new film opens. It's called I Love You, Man. And yesterday, her first book came out. It's called It's Not Necessarily Not the Truth, Dreaming Bigger Than the Town You're From. That town is Kinston, North Carolina. When I met Presley at her current home here in Los Angeles, she told me she loved Kinston, but she always knew she had to leave.
I was always the one in the family that thought outside of the box, or the one in the town that thought outside of the box. I was never really into conforming to, you know, the way of the small town where you wear horse blinders, as my grandmother Presley used to say. You'd wear horse blinders and you see one direction. You don't see what's going on the other sides of you and behind you. And it wasn't so much that I didn't like where I lived, because I love going back home and visiting. It's just, I knew eventually I was going to outgrow it and that I was going to have to go somewhere else.
You mentioned your grandmother, who you write about a lot in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
She was a spicy lady. She had no censor from her brain to her mouth. And she had no fear. She was a very strong woman, strong-willed woman. But she also was very, very old-fashioned and refused to see anybody else's side or to grow with the times, I should say. She stayed in the time that she was raised in, and that was how things should be, and anybody that thought differently was just wrong.
And she was your inspiration for Joy. When you read the script, you pretty much, it seems like, knew that that part was yours.
One of the things about that script, when I read the pilot originally, that immediately made me go, oh my God, this is mine, is the show's called My Name is Earl. My grandfather Presley's name is Earl. And he and I had a very, very close relationship until he passed. And I read this character in the script, Joy, and immediately thought of my grandmother Presley, because there is this need to be the center of attention when she walks in the room. She needs to make sure everybody knows that she's there. She's boisterous. She has sayings that no one else says. At the same time, there's this underlying endearing quality about her, which all of these things that she does and the way she acts is all based on how much love she has for her children and her family.
There's a part of your book where you write about what it's like once you realize that you could play this role of Joy better than anybody. Could you read a bit of that for us?
Sure. There are times when, as an actress, the role you're playing is of a person so utterly unfamiliar that you don't even know how to get into their head, let alone their heart. It's an incredible challenge. Then again, so is playing the role of a person who is extremely familiar to you, but in a different kind of way. I would dare to say that it can be even more of a challenge because of everything you assume you already know. Human beings are complicated. They'll surprise you in a minute, turn left when you think they're going to turn right, flash you a smile when you think they're fixing to cuss you out. Knowing somebody well really only means you've gotten so close to them that the lines in their personality separating good from bad are too blurred for you to even try to judge them anymore. Some people also call that love.
This season on My Name is Earl, there's been kind of a different side of Joy that we've seen, and she's kind of struggled with her past. And it reminded me a lot, in some ways, of you in this book. You know, you came from this small town where things are very different than they are here in L.A. Is there part of your own experience that you tap into when you play Joy?
Part of what makes someone a good actor or actress is someone who can take a character and personalize it in some way. When you've been through something that the character you're playing has been through also, you can kind of start to understand them. And I can say that there's something that all Southern women have in common, and that is that they all have a survival or a survivor instinct, that no matter what happens or what they go through, good or bad, they know they're going to get through it. Very tough, thick-skinned, and not afraid to go through the fire for what they need and what they love.
You wrote this book, and it takes you all the way from your childhood to shortly after you win your Emmy, which I see up there.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's still so much of your life that hasn't even happened yet, mm-hmm. and changes that have happened even since the book came to print. What's that experience like, writing a memoir, but then still there's so much of your life still out there?
You know, that word memoir is so tricky because I've been saying this is not my memoir. Memoir is something I would write when I'm 65 years old. This is stories from my life, I like to say, because I'm 31. It would be asinine for me to write my memoirs at 31. You know, I think that's a little far-fetched and pretentious, definitely. You know, this was meant to be a love letter to my son, and also a story, an uplifting story of redemption, of fight and struggle, of good and bad. And I wanted it to be, I wanted it to influence girls or even, you know, even young boys. I want you to, after you read this book, know that anything is possible. And I want people to know that children are so vulnerable. And any little thing, anything you can do for them, whether it's give them your time or your ear, a pat on the back, or just let them know that you believe in them, the support, that means more to a child and lasts longer than anything you could ever buy them.
Jamie Presley's new book is called It's Not Necessarily Not the Truth. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Day-to-Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand.